From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! U.S. political activist Lori Berenson is sentenced to 20 years in prison by a Peruvian court. We'll speak with her parents in Lima. After white police officers shoot and kill an African-American man in Seattle, community activists adopt a new tactic, pressuring corporations like Starbucks to take a stand. And as the Senate prepares to vote on a patient's bill of rights, we'll have a debate between one of the leading doctors for universal health care and one of the largest associations for managed care. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Lori Berenson was convicted yesterday in a civilian retrial of collaborating with guerrillas in Peru and sentenced to 20 years, a maximum punishment she denounced as unjust, saying again she was innocent of the charges. Counting time served, Berenson is to be released in November 2015, then expelled from Peru. Her father, Mark Berenson, restrained by an American rabbi after the verdict, shouted, "No justice, no justice." A former Massachusetts Institute of Technology student, Berenson was sentenced to life in prison in 1996 by a secret military tribunal with a hooded judge on charges of treason. In a statement yesterday, the U.S. Embassy noted the new trial gave Berenson a chance to defend herself, but said it would have no further comment because the case is being appealed. Earlier in her closing statement, Berenson declared, "I am not a terrorist. I condemn terrorism." She also denied being a member or collaborator of the group, the MRTA. Iraq said yesterday that 23 people died when Western warplanes fired at a playing field in a northern Iraqi town. Britain and the United States flatly deny mounting any attack, saying the deaths were a result of anti-aircraft missiles directed by the Iraqi air defense positions. The Iraqi news agency said U.S. and British warplanes raided the Talifar district near the city of Mosul in what would be the bloodiest reported Western attack for 2.5 years. We'll have more on that story tomorrow. Security officials detained two protesters yesterday after they allegedly ignited a warning flare from the edge of Yekes firing range, forcing Navy jets to abort a bombing run. U.S. Navy officials said the protesters had fouled the range. It was the strongest admission yet from the Navy that the peaceful guerrilla tactics of Vieques activists are effectively derailing the Navy's bombing of the island. Israeli police arrested José Bové, French hero of the anti-globalization movement, and several other people during a protest in the West Bank yesterday, but later released them. Bové had been demonstrating along with around 100 Palestinians, Israeli pacifists, and Americans in the West Bank town of Al-Hadar outside of Bethlehem to denounce Jewish settlements in the area. The World Trade Organization met yesterday in Geneva to discuss making medicines affordable in developing countries amid criticism that its rules on patents are hindering access by the poor to badly needed drugs. 33 African nations demanded the special one-day meeting to look at how to make the WTO's accord on trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, known as TRIPS, more flexible. The accord, which came into effect in 1995, requires WTO members to introduce patent protection lasting 20 years, but the agreement has come in for tough criticism for helping to keep prices of drugs, including anti-HIV AIDS medicines, too high for poor countries to afford. As WTO delegates gathered, 40 people carrying a coffin protested outside. They carried banners calling for the abolition of intellectual property rights, quote, wherever it kills, and saying medicines are not goods. Attorney General John Ashcroft said yesterday that U.S. law enforcement agencies are placing agents and other officials in Canada to fight drug smuggling and other crimes that cross the border. Addressing the Cross-Border Crime Forum, a gathering of top law enforcement officials from both countries in Ottawa, Ashcroft cited plans to bolster border law enforcement, including a new integrated border enforcement team known as IBETS, to operate on the Akwesasne Indian Reservation near Massena, New York, and Cornwall, Ontario. U.S. agents agencies, including the Border Patrol, Immigration and Naturalization Service, Customs Service, and New York Police, would join Canadian police and local agencies on the new IBETS unit. The announcement comes several weeks after anti-globalization protesters held an action at the Akwesasne border. They were protesting Canadian customs officials' refusal to allow U.S. protesters into the country for the Free Trade Area of the Americas Summit in Quebec. The new Army Secretary wants to let private contractors run utilities on military bases, but may remove himself from any decision on the matter over a possible conflict of interest. Enron Energy is one of the companies seeking millions of dollars from the Pentagon to provide those services. Army Secretary Thomas White was an Enron vice president before joining the Bush administration. A military ethics expert questioned White's decision to raise the utility issue so soon on the job. In another embarrassing setback for the FBI, an agency employee has been arrested for allegedly selling bureau secrets to the mafia and criminal defense lawyers for the past 19 months for thousands of dollars. This, according to an FBI spokesperson, James J. Hill, who worked as a support employee in the FBI's Las Vegas office, is charged with theft of government property, conspiracy, and obstruction of justice. He was accused of pilfering top secret files from the office since November 99 and selling them for thousands of dollars to defense attorneys and organized crime figures in New York. A senior military officer warned yesterday that U.S. military and commercial satellites are vulnerable to attack and said the United States must begin creating a system to defend them. Unless more focus is put on, quote, protecting and advancing our interests in space, the United States runs the very real risk of a space Pearl Harbor or other Sputnik that catches us off guard and unprepared, so said Lieutenant General Edward Anderson, deputy commander of the U.S. Space Command. He told this to a House Armed Services Committee. And a human rights group sued ExxonMobil in federal court yesterday, accusing the company of complicity in human rights abuses committed by state security forces that protect its large natural gas field in Aceh. The International Labor Rights Fund brought the lawsuit on behalf of 11 villagers in Aceh who contend that over the last year, they and their families have been victims of murder, torture, kidnapping, and rape at the hands of the Indonesian military unit guarding ExxonMobil's natural gas field. The suit contends that ExxonMobil provided barracks where the military tortured detainees and lent heavy equipment like excavators that were used to dig mass graves. The case will most likely take years to move through the U.S. courts. Bobby McFerrin, Freedom is a Voice. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today we're going to be looking at the case of Lori Berenson, and we are also going to be hearing a debate on the Bill of Rights, the Patient Bill of Rights that the Senate is considering. But first, we're going to Seattle. On May 31st, white police officers once again shot and killed an African-American man. Two police officers stopped Aaron Roberts, 37, on a traffic violation. Roberts attempted to drive away. By the time the altercation was over, police had fatally shot the unarmed man in the stomach. Aaron Roberts' 17-year-old son happened to be nearby and pushed through the police tape to be closer to his wounded father. Police restrained him and then arrested him. With his father dead, he spent the night in the juvenile detention center on charges of assault. This didn't happen in Cincinnati, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, or New York. This happened in Seattle, a city with an African-American population of less than 10%, a city that residents say has been plagued by racism and police brutality for years. Community members have called for citizens' boards of inquiry and an end to racial profiling by the police. They've held protests and meetings with city council members. But then some community leaders launched a campaign unheard of in police brutality cases, a boycott of the Seattle-based multinational coffee company, Starbucks. We're going to talk about that case in a minute, but we've just been told that we have the parents of Lori Berenson on the telephone in Lima, Peru. So we're going to that story first. Again, as you heard in the news headlines, Lori Berenson yesterday was convicted in a civilian court of collaborating with terrorists, the MRTA. She denied the charges. She said that the sentence was unfair. She was sentenced to 20 years in prison. We go now to Lima, Peru, to speak with her parents. Mark Berenson is on the telephone. Hi, you're on the air, Mark Berenson.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, we just heard about the verdict last night. First, the verdict came down, which found Lori guilty of collaborating with the MRTA, and then the sentence hours later, 20 years. Your reaction?
This is absurd. There is this travesty of justice. Lori was convicted of passive collaboration. She was freed of the acquitted of the charges of being a member or a militant of the MRTA. That passively collaborated. The sentence of 20 years, there was absolutely no evidence, no testimony, and no documents that could prove that Lori is guilty of collaboration. This is a farce. Amy, we have the whole thing on film. It was a very open trial. And anyone who speaks Spanish, who watches these 3 months of testimony, 34 sessions, would have to conclude, not as a biased father, but as an objective person, this was a sham of a trial where the judge was prejudiced from the beginning. He should have recused himself. He had said Lori was a terrorist 2 years ago, and then he took the case to grandstand because he was running for public office, ombudsman, a neutral ombudsman of the country, so to speak. The man is a stooge of Fujimori Montesinos. So we've proved that. He said today on radio this trial was totally fair, that they've made changes. Baloney. The only change was that it was open. But the United States State Department, the OAS, the UN, and every human rights group has said that it's impossible to get a fair trial in Peru. Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jackson, last November begged the Peruvian government not to let Lori fall into the cracks of injustice. And sure enough, it happened yesterday. And there was Lori facing her accusers with dignity and poise, standing there passively listening to this horrible verdict and then taking the microphone and saying, Senior Judge, this decision is wrong. I am innocent of these charges, and I'm appealing. And Lori was a tower of strength. As Rabbi Stephen Jacobs said, they must write a new book that John Kennedy once wrote, Profiles in Courage, because she is a symbol of justice, a symbol of strength. And for 26 and a half hours over this trial, she stood in front of the microphone, straight as an arrow, speaking calmly and collectively and cohesively. I'm so proud of her. Every American should be proud of her. Every woman should be proud of her. And she would not sacrifice her beliefs. She may be in prison, but she's free in her mind. She knows, she believes in dignity of all people on this earth, and she's totally clear in conscience. And she would not accept the absurd repentance that they wanted her to do when she's not guilty of anything. Amy, this was the worst thing for a father to see. I had a mixed Father's Day. Kathy yesterday, our other daughter, got her PhD defense. She defended 7 years of research. At the same time, Lori was defending her life. So had a mixed emotion, roller coaster day. But we've got to move on from here. We're going to appeal this case to the Supreme Court of Peru. We're going to keep our case going at the OAS. We're going to lobby in the Congress. And we've got to believe that one day there will be real justice in Peru. But don't let any listener for 1 second think that this country is a democracy. It had wonderful open elections, but a democracy is more than just having fair elections. It's a system, and this justice system is among the worst in the world, and the State Department will have to agree with that. It's not a biased father talking.
Mark Berenson, a three-judge tribunal ruled that Lori had rented a house in Lima for the express purpose of providing a base for the MRTA, bought communications equipment for the group, used press credentials to gain access to Congress. What kind of evidence did they present?
Zippo, zero. Lori admitted escorting her friend Pacifico Castellon, who rented the house, and it was said in court yesterday he was the only signature on the lease. Lori will say, yes, I was with him. We were friends. We rented the house together. It was had no purpose at all for presenting a base to the MRTA. They did not prove that. They said they did, but there's no evidence of that. They said that Lori had false press credentials. The charges that they have are absurd, that she went to the Congress for the purpose of helping plan an attack. There is absolutely no proof of that, and there's just no proof. Amy, there was nobody who testified to these things. Even Castellon, the only government witness, said he didn't think Lori was a member. He didn't think she was collaborating, and that neither of them had any idea that when they were subletting this house to a man that he was going to be using this as a base for the MRTA. She didn't live in that house. When the MRTA arrived, the militants lived on the top floor, and Lori was living in a different section of Lima at that time. So they were very clandestine, and Lori, when she visited her friends whom she didn't know in the house, the three people, she had no idea of the people on the top floor in a house that's now a school that's so large, 4,200 square feet.
Mark,
you can imagine. Yeah.
In her statement, 45-minute speech that she spoke in Spanish, she made a number of references to the teachings of Pope Paul VI and the martyred Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero, and also to the assassinated Guatemalan Bishop Herardi. Can you talk about why she was referring to them?
She was saying that when people stand up and talk about institutionalized violence, which is supposed to be a statement made from the so-called more than progressive left, she's saying these were words that were used by very, very important figures in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. And she was saying that the importance is to provide the social justice for everyone, something so missing in Peru and in other areas of Latin America. And this is why she was referencing that her beliefs are not really non-mainstream. It's just, to her, the dignity of man is the most single fundamental important thing. And she said over and over that every human being must have access to medicine and to housing and to clothing and to education and to an opportunity to work. And every government must provide that in order for each of its citizens to move up the ladder. Nobody should be left behind. And for Lori, those are essential beliefs, and she said over and over in this court, she's being convicted only for her beliefs. And that is the truth. That's why she's in jail. They don't like the type of person she is, a progressive left. But nobody could stand there stronger than Lori did all this time, be calmly speaking in the microphone, and yet corporate networks today in New York are still showing her screaming for 40 seconds years ago. And in Lori's speech yesterday, as she did months ago, she apologized to the Peruvian people for that outburst. I don't apologize for anything, and I realize what anger could make one do. But Lori said, I can understand how the people here saw me. And she told the audience why she was like that, but said, I was wrong. I would say the same words again, which she did. I'm being convicted for my concern of the misery and poverty that exist in this country, and if that's a crime, I'm going to have to accept that as a crime, and I one day believe there will be real justice in Peru. So she said that 5 years ago, but she said it in the sense in her 45-minute speech in a calmer fashion. Yet why are the networks still showing what she did for 40 seconds 5.5 years ago when she was under psychological torture? The real Lori spoke the microphone over these 3 months, 26 and a half hours, 26 and a half hours, not seconds. And she always spoke with the microphone perfectly and never raised her voice. She was berated by the judges in the court, not prosecutors, judges who were acting as prosecutors, and convicted by a man who said she was guilty of terrorism 2 years ago. Now, she is now convicted of passive collaboration, not being a member or a militant. Lori has said over and over, I am not a terrorist. I'm against terrorism. I've always condemned violent terrorist acts. And she has made that point clear. She talks about the suffering that she empathizes for the people of Peru for all these years of violence by all sides and the need for a truth commission, which would come to grips with what is violence and what is terrorism.
Mark Berenson.
She used the magic words. She didn't condemn the MRTA.
And this she was asked to do in the courtroom?
Yes, and the Peruvian law says you cannot be asked these things. Lori recorded, I guess he wants to be a statistician as I am, 50-some violations of her beliefs. Why they were asking her questions. Oh, so you like the music of the Chilean Victor Jara? He's a socialist. And Lori said, I love his music. I'm just sorry she didn't play it on a guitar. And she knows several of his songs, and along with songs of Silvio Rodriguez of Cuba. I'm sorry she just didn't take a guitar in. And it was such a farce, a zoo, a circus. The press were all over. The Peruvian press are like animals. It's supposed to be a polite society. And then we were fortunate that we were the ecumenical delegation of wonderful men, a Jesuit priest from Seattle, Bill Bixel, who's with us now, and Reverend Dr. Bill Nottingham of Indianapolis, the Disciples of Christ Christian Church. And he, for over 20 years, was the chief of missions, sending people like Lori all over the world, particularly in Latin America. And he has said Lori is like all those people, young people he sent for so many years. And then we had Rabbi Stephen Jacobs, who helped Reverend Martin Luther King and Dr. Joyce Brown Campbell retrieve three Americans who were imprisoned in Kosovo, Yugoslavia, last year during the bombing, and they went over and pulled out those Americans. And finally, we had one of the great Americans alive today, the Reverend James Lawson, who is the father of nonviolent disobedience and the teacher of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And he came down, and all four met with Lori, and all four said, if Lori is a terrorist, they are terrorists. One said, if Lori is a terrorist, Jesus is a terrorist. If they said that she is extraordinary as a human being.
Finally,
and that's when Rabbi Jacob said, Profiles in Courage must write a book about her.
Mark Berenson, did the U.S. Congress come out with a statement this morning, or are they? A letter?
I don't know. I hope they will. We are coming back. We are going to have a rally in the U.S. press conference in New York on Monday, and then a rally Monday evening by the Peruvian consulate. We are going to Washington on Tuesday, speaking at the Center of Torture. Lori has written documentation to 7 or 8 women she's imprisoned with who have been tortured by these wonderful Peruvian military police here. And then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we are going to lobby the floors of Congress. We are asking for letters of Congress. We know that President-elect Toledo will be coming to New York and to Washington the same days we're going to be there. And we know, and he knows, that when he speaks in the Senate and the House, that there will be key people saying, que pasa, Senor Toledo, what's the story on Lori Berenson? And we hope that with this newly democratic government of Peru, a man who was educated in the United States, a man who came from abject poverty, is such a great success story of hope for all the people of Peru, and actually all over the world. And we only wish him the best for him and the people of Peru, but we have to appeal to his sense of what humanity and justice is and hope that he could find a way to resolve this terrible travesty of justice against Lori.
We want to thank you for being with us, Mark Berenson, Lori Berenson's father, retired statistician from Baruch College in New York. He and his wife, Rhoda Berenson, were at the months of trial, the second trial for Lori Berenson. She was sentenced to 1996, life in prison by a secret military tribunal with hooded judge that did not allow her lawyer to cross-examine witnesses. She herself was not even allowed to testify or face her accusers. She spent the last 5 years in prisons. The verdict was overturned in August, and she won a civilian retrial. The trial started on March 20th. Again, Lori Berenson maintains her innocence. A three-judge tribunal ruled that Berenson had collaborated with the MRTA and has sentenced her to 20 years in prison, 5 of which she has served. The family will appeal the decision. You're listening to Democracy Now!. Mark Berenson speaking to us from Lima, Peru. Stay with us. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As I said earlier, on May 31st, white police officers shot and killed an African-American man in Seattle. Two police officers stopped Aaron Roberts on a traffic violation. He attempted to drive away. By the time the altercation was over, police had fatally shot him in the stomach. Aaron Roberts' 17-year-old son happened to be nearby. He pushed through the police tape to be closer to his wounded dad. Police restrained him, arrested him. With his father dead, he spent the night in the juvenile detention center on charges of assault. This happened in Seattle, a city with an African-American population of less than 10%, a city that residents say has been plagued by racism and police brutality for years. Community members called for citizen boards of inquiry, an end to racial profiling by police, held protests and meetings. Then some community leaders launched a campaign unheard of in police brutality cases, a boycott of Starbucks based in Seattle. Around 100 people congregated at the Central District Starbucks on June 13th. The People's Coalition for Justice organized the demonstration and was joined by members of an engineers union taking issue with conditions at a coffee bean roasting plant, as well as members of the Green Party. We're joined on the telephone right now by Reverend Robert Jeffrey, the pastor at the Central District's New Hope Baptist Church and one of the leaders of this unique coalition. Reverend Robert Jeffrey, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Why Starbucks?
Well, it's not just Starbucks. It's all of the corporations that are in the Central District. All of the corporations' corporate money is fueling public policy in a way that is not advantageous to the community that are their customers. And we've got to start dealing with the real enemy here. Corporate money is fueling, is giving us politicians who just look at us with blank stares, who don't seem to get it that the community is tired of having the lives of its children at risk on any given traffic stop. That's not democracy, and that's not something we're going to tolerate. We petitioned every politician and petitioned every the mayor, the governor, and everyone else. They seem to not be in control of the city or the state. We believe that the real enemy is the money that's fueling public policy and is driving public safety policy issues in this country. It's coming from corporate America, and we've got to start addressing the real people who run the country.
What is the response of companies like Starbucks?
Well, they act innocent. They act like this is just a community coffee shop. And, you know, most people don't understand that this is a transnational global corporation that that has a less than perfect record as it relates to human rights issues across this country, across the world. But that's not the point. The point is that all we ask them to do is to say simply that they endorse the people's right to have review process and endorse the fact that racial profiling is a crime, and they refuse to make any statements in solidarity with people who are their customers. That is an indication to us that they may be the ones or a part of the group that's pushing the police crackdown on inner cities and gentrifying communities and actually jeopardizing the civil rights and of people who actually whose rights, who don't have any right to who don't have any power to petition when people are being undergirded by the money of corporations, and public policy has been driven by that money.
Reverend Robert Jeffrey, in an article in the New York Times about your campaign, it quotes Wanda Hendren, the Starbucks senior vice president for worldwide affairs, who says business is up since the boycott started. And she says it's not the company's role to form political policy, saying, quote, "We're not an activist or political organization. When people say we should do more than take money from the community, we do give back. What we're willing to do is to help invigorate the community by providing jobs, supporting educational and philanthropic programs for youth. And it hurts us when a small group of people decide that we need to be doing something else, which happens to be on their agenda."
Well, the thing is that it hurts the community when murder and the absence of public policy that's going to address these issues or continue to happen. Murder's been going on in this community for over 30 years. I mean, one of the leading civil rights leaders was murdered in this house, and it has never been solved. It hurts us when public policy is being driven by people who are insensitive to the needs of people who come to their door. Our role here is to educate the community and let the community know what is the proper role of corporate, what corporate America is doing and what corporations like Starbucks are doing, not just here but all over the world, Guatemala. If they say their role is not to mistreat people, then they need to tell that to the plantation workers in Guatemala. Our role is to simply say to people that corporations, if they're going to be in our communities, have to do more than use our children as poster boards for their corporations through small donations and charity. They have to begin to help us develop policy that's going to protect our communities and going to protect our small businesses. If they're not willing to do that, then we have to really start thinking seriously about whether they're real partners with us or whether they're our enemies in many ways.
Can you talk about the coalition that you're bringing together?
It's a coalition of people who are affected and who are outraged by the continued killings. In Seattle, over the last 31, 40 years, there's never been a conviction in these inquests. There's never been anything but accommodations and given to the police who have committed these, in many instances, atrocities. One man was shot laying on his back, looking up at his killer. He shot him down through the neck. He had no weapon on him or nothing. He had just fallen back on the fence and was just outright murdered. One guy was shot with a TV tuner in his hand in a midnight raid. I mean, these things, killings just continue to go on. A mentally ill man was shot last year with no, he was no visible threat and brought up in daylight to the police. This has to end. It's not just in Seattle, it's all over the country. It's a form of terror and intimidation to people of color and to the poor. It's telling us that we get to stay in our place and that the people who have means will run the country and we have no rights. That's not something that's going to be acceptable to us, especially African Americans.
Reverend Jeffrey, you have a history of leading campaigns targeting companies. For example, Boeing. Can you talk about that?
Well, Boeing was selling planes to South Africa during the height of apartheid, and we just simply asked them to stop, and they wouldn't. And they were selling commercial planes, but they were being used as troop carriers. You know, these are all legitimate issues that we believe corporations have to be responsible for.
Finally, Seattle being the site of the WTO protests with 50,000 people that converged there, what is the relationship of the anti-globalization activists and the anti-police brutality protesters?
You know, I think that the role that corporations play in public policy is the issue here. What is that role? And is public policy being influenced by these corporations that exist in our community? We know that corporations spend a lot of money each year to affect public policy in elections. The presidential elections, over $50 million was spent on each candidate. We know that this money is being spent for a reason, and it filters down to the local cities where politicians are afraid to make moves without contacting their corporate contacts. We have to really start beginning to rethink how we apply political pressure in this country. And I think we should start with the corporations in our community. And a lot of corporations feel like just being in our community is a bonanza for us. I think originally we thought bringing corporations into our communities was going to be helpful, but we didn't realize what they thought was helpful was going to be coming in and displacing a lot of the small businesses rather than helping and assisting in partnershiping with those businesses. We didn't understand at that time, like we understand now, that a corporation that comes in has only one purpose in mind, and that is to strip mine the economics of that community and then move on. And those are things, and also to not participate as partners in helping develop policy that's going to help the people of that community.
Reverend Robert Jeffrey, if people want to get in touch with you, where can they call?
Our contact number is 206-323-5958.
One more time.
206-323-5958.
Reverend Robert Jeffrey, pastor at New Hope Baptist Church in Seattle, who is one of the leaders of the People's Coalition for Justice as they target corporations, saying they too have to be held responsible for putting pressure on the police force not to commit brutality. Up next, we're going to talk about the Patient Bill of Rights, but first, a little song from Phil Oaks.
We are the nation's physician. Yes, we give aid to our lobbies every day. We will fight against disease when the money comes with ease, and when we get together we say, hooray for the AMA, and for us doctors lots of higher pay. If you can't afford my bill, don't you tell me that you're ill, 'cause that's the free enterprise way.
Phil Oakes singing the AMA song from the CD, A Toast to Those Who Are Gone. The Senate began debate this week on legislation that would define the rights of patients in a healthcare system increasingly dominated by giant managed care corporations. The debate over patients' rights has triggered a lobbying war of near epic proportions, according to one watchdog group, reminiscent of the political battle over the modest Clinton health care plan of 93, which the insurance industry spent nearly $100 million trying to defeat. The major bill under consideration in the Senate, sponsored by Senators Edward Kennedy, John Edwards, and John McCain, would cover all Americans with private health insurance. It would guarantee patients access to emergency care, medical specialists, clinical trials, and independent medical review of claims denials. The bill would also give patients broad rights to sue HMOs and other insurers when health care is improperly denied. Republicans yesterday introduced a competing bill in the House giving patients more limited rights to sue. The main Senate bill is opposed by the health insurance lobby, the giant law firms that represent them, and major business groups such as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable. They say that an expansive patients' rights bill would drive up health care costs and even force small businesses to drop their health care plans. Supporters of the bill include the American Medical Association and an array of consumer and patient advocacy groups. They argue patients need greater protection from giant healthcare corporations whose profits depend on limiting the services that doctors can provide. But many healthcare activists charge the debate over patients' rights doesn't go far enough and amounts to, as one put it, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. The debate over the patient's Bill of Rights is just as notable for what it includes, but also for what it leaves out. Polls have consistently shown a majority of Americans favor single-payer, a single-payer system of national health care, yet the media discussion of patients' rights, as did the debate over the Clinton health care plan, has excluded all discussion of universal health care. The U.S. spends nearly twice as much as Europe and Canada on health care, yet provides the worst care in the industrialized world for the poor and the uninsured. I'm going to begin today with Quentin Young, National Coordinator of Physicians for a National Health Program. Before we go to our break, can you lay out your assessment of the McCain-Kennedy-Edwards bill?
I think I can. These bills, of course, are the result of enormous unrest in the general public. We should note that in addition to the several bills in the Congress, every single state legislature has a spate of bills across the political spectrum, ostensibly dealing with this problem of patient Bill of Rights. It seems to me a good starting point is to ask, what's going on? Is there a war? Is this a healthcare system, or is it a battleground? Turns out it's more the latter. And the public is hurt every day. As the wrong turn we took, maybe about the time Mr. Clinton's plan was defeated by the big boys, not that it was a good plan, but it was overwhelmingly defeated, and the whole keys to the kingdom handed over to corporate America, where we did something no other country in the world would dream of doing, put health care in the marketplace. Now, markets work in many, many instances. They can be cruel or they can be wonderful. But in the field of health care, it's contradictory. You make money, as they all figured out, by avoiding giving care. And that's what this is all about. Now, to cut to the chase and give an opinion, sure, the Democrat, or actually the Kennedy-Edwards bipartisan bill is better than the other one. It does indeed, interestingly, the battlegrounds around which venue you can sue. The more liberal plan saying you can sue in the states where traditionally the courts have been more generous. The more conservatives want to put it in the federal jurisdiction. Ironically, these are usually the big states' rights guys, but all of a sudden they love the federal judiciary because it gives fewer claims and therefore they want it there.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, Susan Pisano will be with us, Vice President for Communication for the AHP, which is a primary representative organization, largest for managed care in the country. We'll also be joined by Jamie Court, who's written the book Making a Killing. Quentin Young with us, National Coordinator of Physicians for a National Health Program, as the Senate considers the Patient Bill of Rights today. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the Patient Bill of Rights that's being considered by the Senate today, the Majority Leader, Tom Daschle, said that if this is not voted on, there will not be a July 4th break for the senators. Susan Pisano, Vice President for Communication for the American Association of Health Plans. You have more than 1,000 members, the largest in managed care in the country. What is your take on this bill?
Well, we are for patients' rights. We just don't think that Kennedy McCain is patients' rights. And we think that the debate that we've seen waged over the last period of time has confused a couple of things. It's confused patients' rights and suing. It's confused trial lawyer protection and patient protection. What we believe is, well, first of all, I would not accept the idea that health care has deteriorated in the era of managed care. All of the indicators, all the research shows that quality is improving and that people are getting more of the kinds of services that they should be getting, whether we're talking about immunizations or we're talking about the drugs that prevent second heart attacks. Those numbers are climbing as a result of the efforts of managed care. So I wouldn't accept that premise. On the other hand, managed care is new to most people. It's not what most of us grew up with. And we think that there should be a mechanism that assures patients that any decision for covering a particular service is done in a fast, fair, effective way, that the decisions are being made in tune with the best medical science and not with the bottom line. We think the way to do that is for there to be an option for a patient to go to an independent doctor or panel of doctors in what's called independent review if they disagree with a coverage decision. We think that should be binding on the health plan. We think that the reviewers should be at arm's length from the health plan, and we think that it should work as fast as the patient's condition needs it to work. It is the law now in about 40 states. And the early indicators from the states where that's been in effect for several years suggest that it's working, that you see some of the decisions, some of the reviewers agreeing with what the health plan decided, and then you see some of the reviewers disagreeing. So I think that that conveys a sense of fairness.
Jamie Court, your response, Executive Director of the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights.
All three of us would agree managed care could work, but what we have is not managed care. We have managed profits and managed costs, and that's why there has been such outrage across the nation over the delays and denials of care. And the reason we need McCain-Kennedy is because this is the only industry in America outside of the diplomatic community that doesn't have to answer in a court of law when they deny care. When they literally prevent patients from getting something that can save their lives. And there are 150 million Americans right now who do not have a right to go to court to hold their plan accountable. And it's had a real impact on the quality of health care. In states where we have seen the right to sue enacted, like California, we've had it for 6 months. It's a limited right, But we haven't had a single lawsuit. What we have seen from the first statistics out here, which our HMO regulator released, is that HMOs are changing their behavior. They seem to be dealing with their disputes a lot earlier in the process, not letting it get to the point of an independent review where an independent doctor can overturn a decision, because once you enter the independent review process here in California, you do have that right to sue if something goes wrong. And that's exactly what McCain-Kennedy talks about. McCain-Kennedy is giving patients a whole host of rights. It's using as the first resort a system where independent doctors, a panel of independent doctors with no conflicts of interest, will review denials of care by HMOs. And as a last resort, patients go to court. But the reality is there are times when an independent review of a denial of care will not help. If you have a patient who needs to get into an emergency room and an HMO is not approving access or access to a hospital or access to some immediate treatment, then, you know, that there's not really a hell of a lot of time for an independent review. And what's going to matter is the HMO's knowledge that if they get that call wrong, if they don't defer to the medical experts on the scene, they are going to be in court answering for their failure to do so. And that's what McCain-Kennedy has done.
Some specific examples, Jamie Court.
Well, I wrote a whole book of them, and your listeners can access it at makingakilling.org. But we have seen, if you just look big picture, that not-for-profit health plans on a whole host of quality indicators, these are a shriveling breed, but they do far better than for-profit health care plans on a whole host of preventative measures. On a level of patients, we have literally charted hundreds of cases. For 5 months, about a year ago, we sent a different patient story to every member of Congress and the Senate. We called them the casualties of the day, talking about cases. I mean, we have a case of a woman named Florence Corcoran in Louisiana, Slidell, Louisiana. This is a woman who would have benefited from in-home nursing care when she was pregnant. She had a terrible pregnancy and previous pregnancies. Under traditional insurance, they approved the in-home nursing care to watch after her and the baby. And when they switched over to the HMO system, well, they cut that in-home nursing care. Her baby died as a result. She tried to get some justice, went to the courts. The court said, I'm sorry, you've got health care through a private employer. And you know what? What happened to you was wrong, but you don't have a remedy. You don't have a remedy. And now Florence Corcoran's one of the biggest proponents of this bill. Her picture is going to be shown on the floor of the Senate because she went through the justice system. And in America, where we believe that there should be a remedy for every wrong, Florence Corcoran didn't have a remedy for this wrong. And the judges, what's really remarkable is we have Republican judges, people appointed by Ronald Reagan all across the country, who are actually screaming bloody murder over the fact that their hands are tied because of a federal law that precludes them from awarding damages. The only thing a patient in this predicament, a patient with private employer-paid coverage, can recover today in one of these cases is the cost of the benefit denied. They can't get their lost wages. They cannot get punitive damages to punish. They can't get any pain and suffering compensation. They can't get anything. And it's no wonder this industry is lawless. If you had a situation where bank robbers simply had to give back the money they took, you'd have a lot more bank robberies. And that's exactly the legal conditions the HMO industry is operating in for 150 million people. There are 50 million people who can sue, and those people don't seem to be running to the courts.
Susan Pisano is Vice President for Communications for the American Association of Health Plans. Why do you support strict limits on damage awards that can be given to patients when they sue HMOs?
Well, first of all, I would quarrel with the characterization by Mr. Court. I think it's a little bit reckless. But let me say that health plans are already subject to lawsuits in both state and federal court, and monetary damages can be and, in fact, are awarded. What we're talking about in Kennedy-McCain is really an incredible expansion of lawsuits. And we know from experience and research done by very prestigious research organizations that in a significant portion of malpractice cases where you have large jury awards against the physician, there was no malpractice committed. So we have a system that's broken.
But what about this point that Jamie Court made, that even when California opened up this right to sue in the first 6 months, there were no lawsuits?
Well, I think Mr. Court understands full well how long it takes to get a case to court. And I think that you really can't make those kinds of leaps from the time frame that we're talking about. There is also no evidence that having the threat of lawsuits hanging over doctors has been a deterrent to the few doctors who may practice bad medicine, and it has punished everyone else. It has made physicians practice defensive medicine, which means ordering things that aren't necessary and in some cases may be harmful, because the primary idea here is I have to ward off a lawsuit.
Isn't the real issue here, it's not doctors, it's the HMOs that are being sued. It's HMOs making decisions about, for example, a woman who needs to get a sonogram for appendix, and in one of the more famous cases.
Well, a sonogram is not the test used to diagnose an appendix. But let me just...
No, I'm talking about the Pegram case, which is a famous case brought by Cynthia Herdrick, who is the legal secretary from Bloomington, Illinois. Let me just say for our audience, she experienced pain in her abdomen. Dr. Lori Pegram, one of Carl's physician owners, ordered an ultrasound. But instead of doing it immediately at a local hospital, Dr. Pegram decided Herdrick would have to wait 8 days until it could be performed at a Carl-staffed facility more than 50 miles away. Herdrick's appendix ruptured in the meantime, and she sued the doctor and Carl in state court for medical malpractice and fraud.
Well, that was a malpractice case, and it was settled as a malpractice case. I would quarrel with the notion that it is anybody else other than physicians who are making these decisions in health plans. And one of the interesting things about the Kennedy-McCain bill is it not only would bring more lawsuits against health plans, but it also opens more liability for physicians, for hospitals, and for employers.
Well,
Dr. Quentin, yeah.
Yeah, I'd quarrel. There's a lot of quarreling going on with the idea that HMOs do not regularly and intensely control decision-making on procedures and hospitalizations. It's a matter of fact that they have every kind of hurdle, to some of which have been breached because of the publicity. But if they have their way, you'd be talking to a mindless bureaucrat for every procedure. It's a matter of reality, unless we're arguing that the whole nation's gone mad and made up some problems. If I may, before we leave the air, Amy, make the point that I, of course, prefer the stronger bill. It'll help a little bit, but none of this will get us out of our dilemma. We have a corporate-driven, profit-seeking system, and it can't work. Wish it could, but it can't. We need single-payer national health insurance, which excludes venture capital corporate entities from the delivery of care. Until we do that, we're going to be faced with these dilemmas every day.
Jamie Court, the Republicans have now introduced a bill in the House, fearing defections on the issue of patient rights, that goes further than President Bush would like in allowing consumers to sue HMOs and other insurers. Can you explain what that bill is and how it compares to the Democrats' bill?
Well, the main difference between the Democrats' bill and all the Republican alternatives is the limits on damages. The McCain-Kennedy bill, and there are some differences in terms of independent review and how binding it is, and some other minor differences, and the McCain-Kennedy is generally stronger on all those fronts. But on the right to sue, McCain-Kennedy says that, like any other industry, you can take your HMO to state court, and there will be no damage limits unless there are limits in state courts on damages already. And that is when there is a denial of of care, and someone says it's not medically necessary. There's an interference with medically necessary care, the situation that Dr. Pisano said doesn't happen. Then if you have a problem with a coverage dispute, you're not getting something under the language of your insurance contract, you'd have the right to go to federal court. And in federal court, you would have your civil penalties, which are like punitive damages under McCain-Kennedy, capped at $5 million. These other alternatives, be it the Brough-Frist bill in the Senate, has a like a $500,000 cap on non-economic or pain and suffering damages, no punitive damages available. The House bill is a little more generous, but the main problem is that once you take billion-dollar corporations and put some arbitrary one-size-fits-all cap on how much patients can recover, it will alter the financial calculus about how they make decisions about six-figure transplant operations, other expensive treatments. And until a problem presents itself, and I don't imagine it will from what we've seen from other states and from the people who can sue in America, they public employees and people who buy their own insurance, you know, we believe that, like every other industry, this industry should face full liability. And McCain-Kennedy is not single-payer health care. It's absolutely true. It doesn't deal with universal health care at all. That's a whole other problem. But it's actually being portrayed as though it were something that would completely change this health care system. And, in fact, all it does is make the health care system one in which patients have the same leverage they have when they buy a card or sign up for a credit card.
Finally, this issue of Center for Responsive Politics describing what's going on now, a lobbying war of near epic proportions. Susan Pisano, how important is the defeat of the Patients' Bill of Rights for you and your organization, the American Association of Health Plans? Are you just pulling out all the stops now?
Well, there is a lot at stake, and I think that what we have seen is that there are an enormous number of employers who are so worried about this bill and whether they will be able to continue to provide health care for the people that work in their companies. We are for patients' rights. We just don't think that suing and patients' rights is the same thing. We think that the idea is to get patients the care they need when they need it. And that is why we are focused so heavily on this idea of an independent review that should be binding, it should be at arm's length from the health plan, and it should work as fast as it needs to work.
Dr. Quentin Young, in just 30 seconds, on this point, the American Chamber of Commerce and others fighting the Patient Bill of Rights, saying that companies will drop their health care plans. What's your response?
That's the tired response every time there's an attempt to improve patient situations. I would say it would be a wonderful day when we ended the madness of centering our benefits in the workplace. It's been a total disaster. It's enriched a few very powerful agencies and degraded the health care American people, workers and non-workers alike, get. We need single-payer national health insurance.
Well,
that'll solve all of this.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Quentin Young, National Coordinator of Physicians for National Health Program. Susan Pisano, spokesperson for the American Association of Health Plans. And Jamie Court, Executive Director of Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights. His book is called Making a Killing, HMOs and the Threat to Your Health, published by Common Courage Press. And all the contact information, you can go to www.webactive.com, and you can also listen to the program again. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan's our engineer. Earl Maitland, our technical director, from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fired, from the studios of you, our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.